Hello, welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast hangout. This is episode 51, a very special episode, and for this I have here with me Artur Sosins directly from the cold Latvia. Hello Artur, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm good. You're saying cold like it's a bad thing.
Yeah, no, for me nowadays cold is a very bad thing. I have no idea, because over the years I've become a true Brazilian, so I cannot stand cold. At least that's what I felt in the last 2 months that I recorded from Portugal. I hear that after I left, it got even colder. I don't know. Did it get also cold over there in Latvia?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, you told me you have been sick in the latest days. You could not make it to the recording of the PHP Hangout as in previous months. So I hope you are better now.
Yeah, much better. We had a flu. Everyone was kind of sick, but now it's better.
Yeah. So after all, cold is not that good, I think. Unless you want to just jump on the snow. Anyway, we are here to talk about JavaScript, so that's what we are going to talk about. And today we have a special episode because we have been talking about the Innovation Award winners. As you may see here, these are the trophies of the Innovation Award winners. This one is the trophy for the winner of the year. Thomas Björk from Sweden, he's going to get this trophy by mail, but anyway, we'll talk more about that later in this show. Just to tell that they're going to get these nice awards, not only the main winner, but also the country winners. So we are going to get started to talk about the usual JavaScript topics. Let me start sharing the screen here. I'm going to start with an article that's sort of unusual, because instead of common things that sometimes people already know, he comments on obscure things of JavaScript that most people, I suppose, are not aware. So this is an article that talks about some obscure JavaScript pitfalls, and let's talk a bit about this very quickly, because there are quite a few. First, it talks about the array sort of function sorts alphabetically the values, even if the array is made of numbers, which gives some weird effects, like 10 being less than 2, which is sort of interesting. Another interesting topic is that if you want to construct an array with a number of positions, they'll be there, but they are not initialized. So if you try to do something with those entries right away, like calling the map function as they appear here, it will probably not do anything, because the array is practically empty, although the length is set to the specified number. So it has a certain length, but is empty, which is weird. And other than that, he also mentions about something about casting integers may cause overflows. I think this is probably an implementation issue. It probably will not happen in all implementations of JavaScript. Probably some were not thought to be to deal with integers larger than 32-bit. Well, that's my opinion. And then talks about object enumeration order that is not well defined. Well, sometimes enumeration does not really make much sense for for depending on the type of values using on enumeration. Anyway, this is probably related with the sorting issue of arrays that may actually do it by alphabetic order. I'm not sure if it is the same thing. And then it talks about the JSON stringified. It is also not well defined. Well, I'm not sure what was really the problem. Artus, did you got this issue here?
I also experienced it myself. The problem is the same that objects are with object enumeration. The properties may vary from different orders, and so when you JSON stringifies them, it stringifies them also in random orders. So you can't really, for example, in tests, in the end, compare different JSON strings because the properties may be in different orders. You need to compare objects explicitly and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, it's a bit weird, but does it cause bugs or is it something unexpected?
It mattered to me only in the test when I was comparing the results, but I don't think it caused bugs.
Yeah, well, you always learning about yet more weird things. And then it talks about the date get hours and get date that probably will not make much sense, probably on server side, because on the server side there is only one time zone, and that time zone is not the same as the user that probably is accessing via the browser, because the server doesn't, well, I think it could, but it probably won't honor the time zone that the user is on the browser side, because it's a different machine. So, well, as always, it is recommended to you use the UTC functions, get UTC date and UTC hours, because you'll know that UTC is always UTC and it is not subject to daylight savings and things like that. And then it talks about array slice and array splice, that they perform similar tasks, but the array splice actually modifies the array and slice doesn't, which is a subtle difference that once you realize that's the difference, you understand why there are two functions for similar purposes. Well, this is interesting. Well, I have not ever noticed any of these topics. You mentioned that you were aware of at least one of those that affected your code, but what about the others? Were you familiar with them, Artus?
Well, I think that sorting behaved like that, but it doesn't really worry me much. I don't know why. I don't use array constructor, probably for the same reason, but I don't know how to use it. Recently, I ran also into the problem of the number overflow, but for float, which was 2 in 50 second power. So it also has its limits. But all in all, I would not say that they are such a pitfalls. Yeah, maybe something that you need to be aware of. But it always reminds me of one video where I can't remember the name. The guy showed different what happens when you do arithmetic operations on different JavaScript types, and the results are really unexpected. Well, those are sure pitfalls. But they might be obscure, but I don't know. I think that the JavaScript developers mostly are aware that something like that is going inside and using the methods or constructors accordingly.
Yeah. Well, it's. I think it's one of those things that probably you did not expect, and you sooner or later you stumble on them, and then you learn. Oh, now I know. Anyway, these articles are always interesting, so we are going to move on to another article that talks about something interesting. I think this is more Node.js related. which is basically about a way to know which apps you are breaking using static analysis. Well, static analysis you can use to determine what sort of public symbols or objects or modules or variables you are exposing. And if you change something on those externally visible entries, you know the dependencies that may affect other modules or other parts of your code. And so this article talks about using static analysis for that. Well, I did not get much into this, but I know there are a set of tools that can use static analysis for analyzing your code and reach to some useful purpose. Artus, did you use any static analysis tools for any useful JavaScript-related purpose?
I don't think, at least not like that. Here, the interesting part is that they have really multiple endpoints for their application, node application. So it's like every page have its own root or something like that. And in this case, yeah, it would be really hard to analyze it. That's why they even divided the resulting in three different modules. And first one of them is that which automatically finds the entry points, the modules that are not required by any other modules. But I don't think most of that I use only have one entry point, app.js, and it starts from there. So
complicated. Right. Well, it's always great to have those tools available because they are about an advanced topic. Personally, I would not be able to implement any static analysis tools because I'm not an expert on that topic, so it's great to have those tools at hand when you need them. So moving on to the next topic, let me share the screen here. It's about an article that talks about something that I suspect it will be polemic. It starts with the statement, "You don't need jQuery. Free yourself from the chains of jQuery by embracing and understanding modern web API, discovering various direct libraries to help you fill in gaps." It is an article that claims that you don't need jQuery anymore. I think "anymore" refers to the fact that modern browsers implement modern APIs that you can rely on. And so, I mean, apparently rely on different browsers because they would be available, and so you would not need jQuery to deal with the browser differences. Well, this is a big claim. I look into this, and I'm not sure if it is fully true, but well, anyway, the author talks about his story that for some project he had to develop some code that could not rely on external libraries like jQuery, so he had to do it with the existing browser APIs, and he thought it would probably be a pain, but in reality he found it would be a lot easier. Well, not easier, but at least it would not be an L as it used to be in the past, when you would not have all the APIs available on the current browsers. So, in reality, this is an article that has many parts. It talks about different parts. And the next part is about selecting elements without jQuery. Well, all the functions that you would use jQuery probably don't need anymore. Then manipulating DOM elements. And then the next article is about About, let me see where this ends. Making Ajax requests. I'm scrolling. I think I don't need to do it because there is a direct link there. Dealing with events, and I think I'm not sure if the last part is about utility functions. Well, I don't know if it is all that true that you can rely on existing browser libraries and write browser code that will work on different browsers. But because at least some time ago, not a very long time ago, I had to work on a library that I have that would make Ajax requests. So, I still had to put some conditions to test the features of the browser to see if I use some code or some other code, depending on what the browser supported. So, while I like to believe this claim that you don't need jQuery anymore is true, I think it is not that accurate. But I agree that nowadays we are in better shape, I mean, in terms of dependencies on the modern browsers. Obviously, if you still are aiming to support IE6, you are in a lot of trouble. You need probably a whole version of jQuery. Well, anyway, that is my experience. Artus, what is your experience on this topic?
Well, I would say that, as he states in his first blog post, that the trap is real. If you look at a lot Stack Overflow questions and other websites, then there are many web developers that can't really make difference between JavaScript and jQuery. They feel like, okay, there is a jQuery, I don't know what the JavaScript is or something like that. So the trap is real, but in my experience, I actually went completely the other way. I was staying away from jQuery as much as possible. I was using native JavaScript all the time that I could. I've learned a lot about it. And that time, it was all about the challenge. Now, it's about the speed, the time of implementation. So now, I'm just slamming jQuery on it, calling some function, and it all works. So it's the matter of that perspective. And there is also the website Comic Strip, which posts interesting comics about everyday satirical developer life, and one of them was dumping jQuery. And basically, this comic is about that jQuery is so easy that why should you dump it? It's easy to use it. It saves you a lot of time. So that's how I feel about it now.
Yeah. Well. Well, I think it's true. Actually, I also saw a joke somewhere that, I don't know if it was really Stack Overflow or it was a fake page on which somebody was asking how to add two numbers in JavaScript, and then the answers are like, oh, I think there is a function for that in jQuery. And I'm not sure if it was real. I don't remember. It's a shame that I don't recall where I found that, but it was just these days. And it's interesting. Well, I try to depend on less on external libraries, not just jQuery, everything, because there is also the versioning issue that more recent versions do not support all the browsers that, as they used to support in older versions of jQuery. And if I can have code that works with past and future browsers, it's awesome. Although it's like an impossible mission, but at least we try. And also it's great when you can depend only on your code, because if there is a bug, it's your fault and you can fix it. On the other hand, I agree with you that nowadays, sometimes the time of development is more important than being such a perfectionist. Now I can do it without jQuery. Okay, so moving on with the next topic, we are now going to talk about an article that somehow talks about something that we somewhat have already mentioned before. Here it is talking about ECMAScript 6, wherever it is available. I mean, not in the browsers, but maybe in some server-side implementation.
But it will be available in the browsers also. So
right, in the next Chrome version, it will be there. And it tells you that you could have code that would deal with the different versions of the JavaScript version that you have, for instance, on the browser, like having statements that use some code or other code depending on the version. And it even shows some syntax that you could use to run a code if a certain version is available, or some use statement. But in the end, it recommends not relying on versioning, which basically is the same to say it's better to, if possible, rely on feature detection, which I agree it's always better to, well, I don't say always, but it's often better to rely on testing the features if they are available, and use what is available and not relying on version numbers. Well, that's my opinion. Artus, what do you think on this topic?
Agree. Yeah, completely agree. It's better to test the feature than the version.
Yeah, except on the part that you have to know what to test and if there is some jQuery function that can do that for you, you can save time instead of learning how to properly test things. Anyway, this is one topic that I suspect that most people agree with us. But there may be some people that have different arguments. So moving on on the next topic, now we're going to just mention briefly something that is not yet launched, but it is being announced to be launched sometime like in March, March 5th. It even says March 5th at 11 a.m. ET. Very important, announcement time, which is the time of some launch webinar of a project called Native Script, which seems probably not such a new concept, which is basically allowed to develop native applications. I suppose they mean native mobile applications using JavaScript and CSS. And the idea is to have 100% access to native platform APIs using JavaScript, and it seems to be, or aiming to be, device independent. I don't know. This is not exactly a new proposal. The only detail that I noticed, they just say JavaScript and CSS. They don't mention HTML5. So I suspect this is not relying on some web view, because to be in truly native applications, you need to access the APIs that render on screen and things like that, not something inside a web view which would allow HTML5. I don't know, that is my interpretation. Artus, did you look into this? What is your perception of this project?
The company itself, Teletic, was popular for allowing to create enterprise level hybrid apps, and yeah, now they seem to get onto the native apps, which, as you said, won't use a web view. I think the underneath would be a bridge between JavaScript and the underlying language, as we can see in share it quickly in some examples that they have, that basically there would be native classes, UI button for iOS and widget button for Android, and they would wrap it in the same button class for both platforms. So it would be much more towards what Accelerator Titanium had done rather than what PhoneGap does.
Yeah.
So it would really be a native apps, yeah, as you said.
Right. Well, this says it, this does not rely on HTML5, but it seems to rely on some XML definition of pages and screens and stuff, which looks pretty much like ASP.NET. I don't know, because these guys are too attached to the Windows world.
No. Android has similar XML definition, so it's probably going more from Android here. But yeah, Titanium accelerators, they have also Alloy, which also provides a way to define all the UI in XML. It's a common practice now.
Yeah. The only thing is that you cannot use a real browser to preview this, I think. I don't know. Because it's not HTML5. But they probably provide some kind of emulator. Well, although this is a commercial project, and which means it will cost money, I'm not sure if there will be like a basic free version. Personally, I like the idea because I don't feel like going through the pain of developing code that needs to be very close to native Java for Android, Objective-C for iOS. They also support Windows phones. I'm not sure what is the share of Windows phone these days. Probably very small, but okay. I don't think it will hurt. Anyway, personally, I like the idea. And probably this may be interesting also for commercial developers, because they probably will provide a way to develop commercial components that can be sold to other developers and save time of development, even if they cost some money to acquire. I did not read this. I'm just jumping to conclusions, but I think the idea could be interesting. So let's wait until March 5th and let's see what comes up from there. Although all my life I've been using and develop open source code, I think existing commercial products do not hurt if you don't like commercial or closed source. Software just don't use it, but
native script actually open source the base that
yeah,
they are using.
Probably not totally open source, because this is a company that needs to make money somehow. So let's wait and see how open is the source. And I don't believe in miracles. I know every company has the right to make money somehow. Maybe it's not in the implementation of this, but could be some other way. Let's wait and see what exactly it will be. So moving on with the next topic, which is about also a commercial tool, but as a free version, which is to scramble JavaScript code. It's called JS Scrambler. It seemed interesting. Let me put this in English. For some reason, it assumed that I wanted it in Portuguese. Probably because I am in a Portuguese-speaking country. Anyway, well, the idea of scrambling is taking your code and rewrite it somehow that it will be unreadable for somebody that just arrives here and takes a look at it. It changes lots of the names of variables, and it makes it harder to understand for people that you may not want for some reason to understand it, like some boss that wants to edit your code and he's not even a developer. I heard stories, horror stories of customers, of consultants that have developed projects, and for some reason the person that paid for the work thinks he knows about programming and goes and mess up the code directly. So although unscrambling is always possible, it will be hard for those bosses to fiddle and make a hell of your life messing your code when you didn't want them to do it. So this Jesk Scrambler has a free version. I'm not sure how this works. Is this the web service or not? Well, it supports... there is a free version up to 25 files per project. I don't know how many projects it supports. Oh, it's an API. Oh, okay. Now I get it. It's an API to do the scrambling, and it also not only does it can do optimization. Okay. Well, it is interesting. It's a commercial project again, but it may be useful when you really would rather pay for a solution that does not cause you problem with nosy bosses.
I don't think that actually would be the main reason. I think the main would be if you are selling scripts online, then with both PHP and JavaScript, the code is open and everyone can ship them somewhere or upload them to torrents, stuff like that.
Yeah,
and this kind of security prevents them from doing that because you can embed some license checks inside and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's true. That is also a possibility, and I'm sure people that are willing to sell scripts would like to avoid also that problem. Although one problem of shipping scrambled code is that if there are some errors, probably the line numbers get messed up, the variable names are totally different, and for debugging is probably not very useful, but okay, I will get either one thing or the other. So, well, you can't get everything just doing this scrambling. So moving on to the next topic, which is about a library. I'm not sure it is useful for everybody, but I thought it was curious just to mention it briefly. It's called GitLab, and it's basically Git implemented in JavaScript. I think that when they say Git implementation, they mean Git client, because Git uses a protocol, a client-server protocol, that I think it will just implement this library just implements the client side, which is still useful, I think. For some reason, you want to use Git for some purpose. I don't see a personal purpose for my own projects, but maybe other people find it useful. Artus, what do you think? Do you find this useful for any projects of yours?
I don't know. I'm just looking at the code, and it seems it still uses Git from the command line. So what does it exactly have to do with JavaScript?
I think the probably it's a library that you can call it from JavaScript code. I mean, probably Node.js-based code. And it also generates an executable command that you can call from the command line. Well, that's me guessing, because I didn't look inside of this. Oh, it's either that, or it is just a funny way to say I'm not using Git, I'm using it all from JavaScript, but it still is from the command line. Well, I don't know. It may have its purpose.
Yeah,
it's just for you to not have... You can use Git without having the Git program installed. As long as you have Node.js installed, it will work fine. well, that's what I got. I'm not sure if this is the way this project was meant to be. Okay, now moving on to another topic, which is about an article that I wrote precisely because I've been working on something that I must say it was painful, which is adapting a website to make it more mobile friendly. So this article is basically to tell what I learned. So for the last 3 months, actually more, I've been working on making PHP classes and JS classes mobile friendly. So this article tells you about it tells about 10 tips, but in reality there are more tips than just 10. The 10 tips that it mentions is about make it responsive, but the site tells you first about the motivations to make a site mobile friendly. Well, in the case of PHP classes, JS classes, over time they have been accessed mainly by desktop users, because developers that are accessing the site, they want to download components, so they are not going to download to mobile phones or tablets, except maybe for some types of pages like blog articles that people just want to read and probably want to read it from a mobile device, like for instance this article. And so over time, it's like the site only had like 8% of the users are using it from mobile devices. But still there is a growth of, last year it was like 6%, and now it's 8%. So the mobile user is growing, but it's not still a typical site to be used from mobile devices. But what motivated this development, at least it was the trigger, was that Google announced that sites that are not mobile friendly, they eventually be penalized soon in the next weeks, months, we don't know. Google never pre-announces the updates and their algorithms. So if you fear that your site may be penalized because your site is not mobile friendly, maybe making it mobile friendly is the time. Anyway, the article starts saying that making the site mobile friendly should be done for your users, not for Google, because Google, whatever they are changing their algorithms, is always to motivate developers to make the sites better for their users. So you should always be concerned with your users, not with Google. And then the article talks about different approaches to address better the needs of your mobile site users. And it talks about four approaches that you can follow, not exactly. Well, it's just three approaches and then one alternative solution, which is not really about the site. The first approach is to create an alternate site for mobile site users, which basically it's practically like having the same efforts that you had to create the site for non-mobile users, because we had to create eventually different layouts, but serve them in a separate site. The second solution is to use dynamic serving, which is basically the same, except that the mobile and mobile versions will be served from the same URLs. And again, this is also like having the effort to create a new site. And the third solution is to create responsive web pages, which are basically web pages that only have one version of your HTML code. And then they use things like media queries and things like that to adapt your page's layout to your site users. And then the fourth approach, which is not really to change your site, is more to implement a mobile app. And that probably makes more sense when the interactions with your users are very intensive for mobile devices, probably transactional websites, like sites that implement services, personalized services, not just showing pages that will be the same for different users. And well, this is a different approach, not really adapting your site, but I put it here because you may also consider creating a mobile app and also adapting your site to mobile users using these approaches. So in the case of PHP classes and JS classes site, it was used the approach to implement responsive web pages, which is basically the core of this article, which are the 10 tips that follow below. Before moving on, just to comment about this, Artus, what is your experience with adapting sites to mobile users? Did you ever have to go through the work of converting the site to make it mobile friendly, or your efforts were more just to begin with a site that is mobile friendly from the start?
Mostly they are either mobile friendly from the start, or if clients wants a responsive website, then it also gets a new design, so it's also created from the start. I actually can't remember any work that I would have to convert existing design, because it would be very, very hard thing to do.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Hats off to you, because you could break many things. You could do a lot of stuff there, and that's really a complicated task. It's better to create from scratch.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it's better to create from the scratch, because that's even more work.
Well, it's easier, but, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, well, in the end, I realized that it's not that hard, but it's still a lot of work when you have lots of different types of pages, which is the case of a site that is reasonably old, like PHP Classes and JS Classes. There's code that was written there in 1999. It's really, really old. And the idea of this article is to teach some tips that you could apply to make it less of a pain, because it will always be a pain no matter what, regardless of your approach. It will always be a pain if you have to start with a site that was not mobile friendly from the start and have to adapt. So I wrote this tell about these 10 tips just to cover the year very briefly. The first tip is to help you to decide what is the priority, because when you have many types of pages, you ask yourself where I'm going to start. And the first tip gives you an hint, which is to start with your most visited types of pages. And it talks about there is a tool inside the Webmaster Tools, that Google Webmaster Tools, that gives you the list of the top pages that are getting traffic from Google. So if you are in a rush and you don't want to get caught by any penalties, the sooner you will address those pages, the better. So those should be the pages that you should get started. But not just for Google, but also because those are the most visited pages by your users. So the sooner you fix those pages first, the better. And it tells you about here this report of search queries that shows top pages. And they are not grouped by URL because Google Webmaster Tools have no notion of URL patterns. But here I mention a PHP class that I developed that can retrieve that report of the top pages that are visited, and then you can put them in an array and probably sort them so you can have be more certain which are the groups of pages that are more visited. And obviously in the case of the PHP classes, the top visited pages are the ones that for package pages, but then was not sure which ones would the next types of pages would be, and then with this tool I realized it would be the blog pages that also get lots of accesses, and then other individual pages like the home page and others of authors and groups, categories and so, files and so on. Then the next tip is to use the browser developer tools to preview your pages in small screen so that you can look at them, how they look in your browser. For instance, you can use the Google developer tools. Nowadays, every thing of previewing the your pages in the size of different types of mobile devices. And I think Firefox Developer Edition has a similar tool. I don't know about other browsers. Arthur, I think you use Opera, right?
I have used it a lot, but now I'm more on a Chrome tool, basically.
you gave up on...
Yeah.
Okay. So when you use... I don't know if Opera has anything like this these days. Maybe it has. You can go here and just do this and adjust the size of the screen for certain devices, and then you can see that it adapts. There are several tricks applied here that I mentioned in the other tips, like how to adjust things like images so they still look properly scaled out. But okay, let's move on the other tips. So the second tip would be that to use the browser developer tools to preview your pages in small screens and start fixing your pages. The next tip is to use to fix the viewport definitions to adapt to the screen size. The viewport is the visible part of the browser. Meaning that, for instance, if the page does not fit on the viewable part of the browser, it will show some scroll bars. So the viewport is only the visible part, and using this meta tag, you can make it adjust to the device width, and then it probably adjusts the zoom scale to make it fit there or not. It will depend on whether your page fits or not. The next tip is about starting with page headers and footers, because if your site is big, you have to start from a certain point. But if usually sites have something in common, different pages have something in common, which is the page headers and footers. So that's what I did. The first thing that I did is start adjusting the headers and footers of all pages so they can fit and start converting menu bars into buttons, which is the next topic. For instance, if you have wide navigation bars like you had in this site, you had these navigation bars. On the top, you also have this navigation bar. So when I adjust it to the mobile size, these navigation bars turn into menus. And let me Okay, let me get back to the point. The next point tells about you how to build these menus. In reality, this is one of the disadvantages of the responsive approach. Sometimes you cannot use the same HTML and put some media queries and make it all fit well in mobile screens, small screens. So what I had to do is to put two types of menus, one for mobile and one other for desktop. So when the screen is too small, it will show one, and when the screen is large enough, it will show the other. That's what happens here. So this was a trick. The next point here related with these menu buttons is that it also teaches a trick how to create a menu with some div statements and do not need to use any JavaScript to toggle the menu to show and hide. You use an hidden checkbox and certain CSS styles trigger depending on the state of the checkbox, whether it is checked or not. And so all those menus that I've shown here, they in reality have this icon or the menu is a label with an image. And when you click on the label, you toggle the state of the menu using some CSS that is given an example here. The next topic, the next tip is what are you going to do to start fitting things that will not fit on small screens? You have to start sacrificing less important information. For instance, information that is repeated, you start sacrificing, like for instance these menu bars here, they will be shrink to the point they would disappear when the screen is too small, so they can start adapting until all fits. And the recommendation, at least for Google tools, is to keep shrinking until you reach the size of the iPhone 3GS screen, which is 320x480. Once you have fitted in all that screen, you can stop going further and make it fit in smaller screens, because nowadays probably nobody using these screens that small, at least for smartphones, I think. And then the next topic, the next tip is to use Google PageSpeed Insights to figure any pending issues that you may have. For instance, if you have adapted your page and you think, no, I think I'm done, then you can test the page, put the page in production, and then pass the URL to the Google PageSpeed Insights tools, and it will really tell you if you have fixed all the topics or not. And sometimes you realize there are still issues, like buttons that may be still too close, and that probably is not a very good thing. You need to sort that issue too. And using this tool, you find what are the pending issues that you still need to fix. The next tip is about adapting images to fit on the page with limits. For instance, this article had images. When they get too small, they would not fit. So the tip here is to use some media queries to make the width be as large as possible, 100%, and then use the auto height so it will keep the proportions. Resize the image and keep the proportions. So this is an interesting tip. Another tip that I mentioned is that when you try to fit things, in small screens, they probably you probably will find the links and buttons that are too close, and so you need to put enough padding around so when the user touches on those links or buttons, it will not touch in the next button by accident. So you should add enough padding around those links or buttons to make them be separated enough, not just horizontally, which would happen with text. You should just define some pixels of padding, but also vertically, lines should be spaced enough. So if you put the line height style to 200%, it will address that problem. And the one final tip is to figure how much you have done in your site and how many pages you still have to do is to use the Google Webmaster Tools mobile usability reports that they tell you how many pages you still need to fix and what type of issues they have. So you can sort your priorities and try to address as much as possible in the least time possible, and address most of the issues the sooner, if possible. Well, this is a quite long and detailed article. Artus, I don't know if you have read the article before. I don't know if you have any other tips, any other things you wanted to comment that would be worth mentioning regarding this topic of adapting to mobile.
Firstly, I want to say that it's really, really detailed, really good, great article that really provides the insights on what had been done and what to look for. Maybe the only thing that you could have mentioned, but knowing you, you wouldn't mention it, is some kind of third-party scripts that could help you with that, like I don't know, Twitter Bootstrap framework or other grid layout could help. But not everyone uses them, not everyone needs them, so maybe it was not also such an issue.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't. I thought about that, but since I did not use those solutions, because usually those solutions are great when you are getting started with a mobile-friendly site, which is not the case. I was adapting an existing site. It was not done from the beginning with Bootstrap or somehow a library, so probably it would not make sense. But I agree with you. If you can get started with one of those libraries, it will probably will be less of a pain because many matters are already sorted, and you probably can reach to a more mobile-friendly users solution to users that will access your sites from a mobile device. Not just for mobile sites, but probably for an hybrid application that can install on a mobile device, but since it is HTML5 based and CSS based, you could use it to make it fit and layout fine on mobile devices and still be a native app. Well, actually, an hybrid app. Okay, but given that, let's move on to one final topic, one of regular section on which we comment about the Innovation Award nominees. But this time, as I mentioned, we are going to talk about first the Innovation Award winners of 2014. So the last nominees were published the classes in December, so they were voting in January. So in February, the final results came out, and the great big winner of the year is Thomas Björk from Sweden. Congratulations to Thomas. By the way, Thomas, if you are listening to this hangout, I hope you can get in touch, because I've been trying to get in touch with him since the beginning of the month, because he is entitled to one of these prizes. Let me show you again. This is the trophy, as you may see. I don't know if you can read it. It says JavaScript Innovation Award, the name Thomas Björk, and he's going win this nice trophy that was done with a lot of love and care to all the winners. And when I say all the winners, I mean not just Thomas, because Thomas won individually, but also the all these other four trophies are for the winners of the country that won by countries. So Thomas won by individually. Yes, exactly. And he won with four packages and 15 points. Many other authors participated, like David Castillo from Mexico, Pierre Faux from France, Jimmy Wolf from Canada, and with Jordan Marmalier from Spain, and Miral Port from France, Andrew Stott from Hungary, John Diaz from Colombia, and Jacob Kroll from Poland, right? And Raul from Brazil. They all did great, but Thomas got more packages and more points for his participations. But by country, the country that won was France with 6 packages and 23 points. And so collectively, France won thanks to the contributions of several authors, actually 4. Pierre Fouque with 12 points, Emmanuel Podvin with 8 points, Kiwan with 2 points, and Jonathan Gotti with 1 point. And all of them are going to get these trophies, which are slightly different. And they say JavaScript Innovation Award winner, the name of the winner, and Team France, because he won by team. They won championship by country. And other than these trophies, they are also going to get one of these PHP elephants. There are no JavaScript elephants, unfortunately. I don't know if there is a mascot for JavaScript. It would be interesting. I don't know. Artus, have you heard of any JavaScript mascot?
No, not really. So I've been looking into that sometime. But also didn't find anything.
Well, every popular language deserves a mascot. If anybody really cares about JavaScript, let's not give PHP elephants to JavaScript developers. They deserve some JavaScript elephants, maybe, or some other animal, or some other mascot. Anyway, congratulations to them all. I know that only a few I have contacted them all by email, but unfortunately, not all of them have replied. So, if you are listening to this, please get in touch, because I need your addresses so I can send you all these nice prizes. And as I was mentioning, many other countries did well but did not make to the first place. So, like Sweden, 4 packages and 15 points, Mexico, 2 packages and 13 points, Spain, 3 packages and 12 points, Canada, with 4 packages and 11 points, Italy, 3 packages, 8 points, Hungary, 2 packages and 7 points, United States, 3 packages and 6 points, India, with 2 packages and 6 points, and Brazil, 1 package and 5 points. So, the Innovation Award contest of 2015 is already going on. There are already nominees in January, and I hope in February more potential nominees submit their packages so they can be nominated to the Innovation Award. So given this, we are going now to move on with commenting on the nominees of the last month. Actually, now I want to talk about the nominees of November 2014. They were voting December, and then in January the results come out. So that's why we are only talking about them now, so to not influence the voting process. So, Arturs, which ones would you like to comment about? There are like four nominees. Which ones you like to comment?
Let me first comment on the my own.
Oh,
I think.
exactly. You were nominated.
Okay. So basically, I had a purpose. There was a user registration lag, and in most cases, by default, user do not submit avatars. So the idea was to create a class that would generate like an image from the name or surname that they provide. Basically, what it does, it takes a hash from your name and generates color from that hash, and then it's uses your initials and puts in a complementary negative, like other color, the text, so they stand out from each other. And this way, from your name, there is generated an avatar that is used in your profile. I think many sites are using it, but I didn't really find the script that would be available to use it,
Yeah.
so had to make my own here.
I have seen sites that use a sort of QR code or some abstract drawing for.
Oh, that's probably from Gravatar. You need to provide an email address, and then you can generate different Gravatar, global avatars.
Oh, with Gravatar. Okay.
Yeah, it could be
But
from.
I think your package is simpler, but it makes more sense because after all, it's the initials of the author name that are there.
Yeah. And the second one I wanted to comment on is from Mehdi Savafi from Iran. And what he does, we can also demonstrate. I love the demos tab. Sometimes you have links in the web page, which let me find one. No, it's not this one. There are links in the web page that jump to other links, but I can't
I
find
think
any.
it's the links from those at the top table of contents.
Then they not seem to be. They seem to be leading to something. Oh yeah, this one. The contents are actually a thing. Yeah. Wow. So you see?
Yeah, it's awesome. It's a ni very nice effect. It's not
Yeah.
just scrolling, it just shows you a flying arrow.
Yeah. That's just awesome. So actually, retrieving the event is already hard. You need to override the default browser behavior to apply some tricks, but the effect is just wow.
Yeah, that's
So,
true.
yeah.
That's really impressive. Congratulations to Mary Savi, and for that you won a license of the IP to country database. So congratulations for him for
Yeah,
the
developing Flyme, I
yeah.
think.
So on my behalf, I'd also like to comment about the other two packages that were nominated. Specifically, one that is very interesting, Web Code CAM, which is basically a jQuery plugin that can scan, can use the webcam that you have on your computer or mobile device or whatever, and what it does, it can capture the image from the webcam and put it on a canvas and try to decode the code that is in there, either being a barcode or QR code. So this is a very interesting package from Anders Toth from Hungary, and I find it interesting, and it's not sure. Yeah, well, I could demonstrate it, but I cannot use my webcam here. But okay, it has also a demo. It's great that now authors are always providing viewable demos because it helps demonstrating what the package does. So for this, Andres is entitled to a prize that he picked to be one book of choice from O'Reilly, actually an e-book. And then the other package that I wanted to comment, called JavaScript CSS Generator, it's from Jimmy Bo from Canada. And what it does, it generates CSS styles dynamically, which is can be very useful in certain circumstances on which you need to alter certain characteristics of your styles dynamically. And with this package, it sort of provides an API to do that, and it is useful for many purposes. So kudos to Jimmy Bo, and for that he picked one book of his own choice by pack. So with this, we practically reached the end of this Hangout podcast. Once again, congratulations to all the winners of the Innovation Award. You'll get these trophies and that JavaScript elephant.
And you should come up with your own mascot, JavaScript mascot, and force it. I think the most would accept it.
That's the thing that I'm going to do when I finish to make the whole site mobile friendly.
Okay.
After many months of work.
You can start, like, I don't know, a submission box so others could submit their ideas and drawings.
Actually, this elephant is not really the original PHP elephant from Vincent Pontier. This one was created by a contestant that won a design contest for the PHP Cluster site, like in 2009 or 10, and not only they wanted to provide a new template, new CSS icon design, they also wanted to add a new logo. So I thought, how it would be interesting to convert the logo into an elephant mascot, because the elephant mascots that based on the Vincent Pontier design, they were hard to find, hard to buy by then. So it would be better. I found it would be better if I could produce them. So it ended up working well. I already contacted the winners that were going to get them. Many of them are very exciting to get one of these elephants. So even though some are for JavaScript contributions, but that's all fine. Most of them are also PHP developers, so they will appreciate. So once again, congratulations to all, and keep sending your innovative packages so you can win the 2015 award. So with this, practically reach the end of this podcast, and on my behalf, that is all for now. Bye.
Bye.